Chapter 6.
"Good job," Nick whispered as we walked into the morgue. "I'll admit, I was worried you wouldn't be able to pull it off, but this is fantastic. We don't even need a chaperone."
As Peter had promised, the guard had let us through as soon as I showed him the note. He didn't even ask about Nick, which struck me as sloppy. But I guess you didn't get many complaints when all of the people you'd been hired to guard were dead. Now we were walking together into the enormous, freezing warehouse that held the DFZ's corpses. Just as with the offices, it looked astonishingly normal. A big, open room filled with huge racks of metal shelving, stacked all the way to the high-efficiency lamps built into the ceiling. If the plastic-wrapped objects we were walking past had been rectangular, I could almost have imagined we were in a normal warehouse for perishable items. But they weren't. They were body bags. Very obviously so. And I was sorely wishing I'd never gotten involved.
"We are so cursed," Nick harrumphed. "You're just being superstitious."
"It's not superstition," I cried. "The mortal spirits are real. You live in a moving city. How can you doubt this?"
"I don't doubt it," he said, checking the numbers on each block as we went past. "I just don't think they care as much as you do. The empty wind is responsible for all the people who've ever died and been forgotten. What are the odds he's going to notice one cybernetic hand out of billions of souls? And even if he does, why would he care? He's just going to be cremated along with the rest of the body."
"It's the principle of the thing," I said stubbornly. "We're stealing from the dead."
"Stop calling it stealing,"
Nick chided, stopping in front of a tall stack of bodies beside the wall.
"You bought both of his units. Technically, all of his material possessions are yours now, including his fake hand."
I didn't think the death god would see it that way. I had minored in religious folklore for my degree, and I knew from countless stories that trying to slip around divine edicts on technicalities usually got you into more trouble, not less. But it was too late now. Nick was already punching the number from the sticky note Peter had given me into the sorter. A few seconds later, a giant mechanical arm slid over the rail set in the ceiling. When it was directly over our heads, it plucked the slab with the correct number on its barcode off the second highest shelf and dipped down, pneumatic gears hissing as it lowered the body all the way to us on the ground.
"Right,"
Nick said quietly, pulling a heavy pair of cleaning gloves very similar to mine over the thinner leather driving gloves he usually wore.
"There's a camera directly behind us."
"Don't look," he hissed when I started to turn.
"Just stand there and block it. I'll get the hand."
I stood where he told me, heart pounding harder than ever. No matter what Nick said, I couldn't shake the feeling that this was wrong. Probably because it was. I knew that. And here I was doing it anyway because apparently I'd rather anger a death god than miss a payment to my dad. But no matter how firmly I told myself I'd chosen the lesser of two evils, it sure didn't feel that way. Especially not when Nick reached out and unzipped the plastic, filling the morgue with the reek of decay I remembered from this morning.
"Ripe, isn't he?"
Nick whispered, wrinkling his nose.
"Which hand is it?"
"His left," I whispered back, wrapping my arms around my torso so I wouldn't shake. "Be gentle, please."
"Why?"
Nick asked, shoving his gloved hand inside the white plastic sheeting to grab what was left of Dr. Lyle's left wrist.
"He's dead. What's he going to do? File a complaint about—"
He cut off with a sound that made me jump. It was halfway between a choke and a gasp, but when I looked to see what was wrong, Nick wasn't moving. He was just standing there like he'd been frozen, his eyes so wide I could see the whites all the way around. I was still trying to figure out what had happened to him when a cold draft blew past me. I jumped again, eyes going wide. A wind was rising.
Since I'd left my protective poncho in the car like an idiot, I could feel it all the way up my bare legs and on the back of my neck. Even in the chill of the morgue, it was piercingly cold. As cold as the grave. And as it blew over me, it spoke.
What belongs to the forgotten remains to the forgotten.
Now it was my turn to choke. The words hadn't come from a voice. They weren't sound in my ears or even a pressure on my skin. It was my magic the voice spoke into, each word sending little puffs of icy breath through the secret space in the back of my mind I'd come to think of as my soul.
"Leave," it whispered. "You both are guilty. But you showed remorse. So you shall be let off with a warning. This one, though."
There was a horrible creaking sound, and Nick gasped again.
"This one will pay."
The voice vanished then, leaving me gasping as I whirled to look at Nick, and started to panic. In the brief time I'd been caught by the voice, Nick's face had gone as white as the plastic body bag. He didn't look like he could move, but his eyes were darting frantically down. When I followed them, I saw why. Something invisible was pushing into the skin of his neck. I could only see it from the imprint the pressure made on his flesh, but it looked as though a giant transparent hand was wrapped around his throat. When I reached up to try to pry it off, the cold was so intense it burned my fingers, making me gasp in pain.
"Leave the thief to his fate."
"No," I said, scrambling into my bag for the notes I'd taken from Dr. Lyle's Holmes. "We're not thieves, and this man is not forgotten. His name is Dr. Theodore Lyle, and he died trying to hide his life's work from some very horrible people." That was all supposition. I had no idea why he'd been hiding down in that hole. For all I knew, he really was a criminal who'd stolen from his boss just as Kaufman had claimed. But that wasn't what I believed. I'd never met Dr. Lyle, but I'd been through two of his homes now, and everything I'd seen told me that this was someone whose interests and values lined up with my own. He was also a collector, someone who appreciated history, and who'd died with work unfinished. I didn't know why he'd wanted cockatrice eggs so badly, if it was just for the money or if there was something else, but he'd cared enough to hide his notes in a hole at the bottom of the underground, rather than let Kaufman have them. I might not have known Theodore Lyle as a person, but I'd seen his work and how far he'd gone to protect it, and that was enough to let me jump to the conclusions I needed. "We need this hand," I told the cold presence wrapped around Nick like a noose. "It's the only thing that can tell us where Dr. Lyle hid the project he died to protect. If we don't find it, his work will either fall to his enemies or be lost forever." I put my hand on Nick's shoulder, which was now as cold as the wind surrounding us. Dr. Lyle might have died lost and forgotten, but he's remembered now. We know his work, and his enemies are after us because of that. But if you let us take his hand, we can beat them. We can find the ritual Dr. Lyle died working on and bring it back to the world. We can rekindle his memory, just as Peter said. That's what matters the most, right? Historically, lying to gods never went well for mortals. In my desperation, I'd decided to try anyway. But no one's surprise was greater than my own when I discovered that it wasn't necessary. I hadn't put it together until the empty wind had forced my hand. But as I spoke the words, I realized they were all true. Maybe not for altruistic reasons. But whether we made a profit or not wasn't really the point. What mattered to the empty wind was the fulfillment of the soul. He didn't care about me or Nick. He just wanted justice for the lost life I'd been digging through all day. So that was what I offered him. Falling to my knees because that was what you did when you were begging a god. "Please," I whispered, bowing my head. "I'm sorry we tried to take the hand without permission. I'm sorry I tricked your priest. I should have told him the truth from the start, because we're all on the same side. And that's Dr. Lyles. That hand belongs to him. And I swear I will not sell it. When this is over, I'll give it back to you. I'll give it a proper burial, or burn it, or whatever you want. But until then, I need it to save his work. Ask Dr. Lyle if he's there with you. I'm sure he'll say yes. Just please don't kill Nick. I can't do this without him."
There was a long pause, which I hoped meant the god was considering my words.
He must have found something in there to believe, because a few heartbeats later, Nick collapsed to the ground beside me, clutching his neck as he gasped for breath. I was slumping in relief when the cold tightened around my own throat.
"The living forget," it whispered. "But I do not. I will hold you to your promise, Opal Younge."
I couldn't speak to answer. Every part of me was frozen as Nick had been. But unlike him, I was a mage. I wasn't strong enough to push the spirit of the forgotten dead away. No mortal was. But I could let him in, dropping all my defenses to let the wind blow through my mind and see that I was sincere. There was no way to hide that I was also doing this for the money, but I hoped the rest would make up for that. The empty wind wasn't a god of morality anyway. I'd never once heard of him judging the living. In all his stories, he only cared about justice for the dead. And there, at least, our objectives aligned. I just hoped it was enough. But though it took a while for the icy wind to pass completely from my mind, in the end, he let me go, dropping me on the ground the same way he'd dropped Nick. Dr. Lyle's cybernetic hand hit the floor a moment later, the metal fist clanging against the smooth cement like a cymbal.
"It is given," the god whispered over the noise. "Take it and go. But do not think I am not watching."
I was coughing too hard to reply, so I nodded instead. But the supernatural cold had already vanished from my body, leaving only the normal chill of the morgue and the grip of Nick's gloved hands on my shoulders.
"Opal,"
he whispered, giving me a gentle shake. When I didn't reply, the shaking got less gentle.
"Opal!"
I put my hand up before he shook my head off, coughing even harder as I struggled to clear my clenched lungs. When I could finally breathe again, I collapsed on my stomach on the cold floor. I was still wiping the stress tears from my eyes when Nick's hands returned.
"We need to go,"
he said, his voice tight.
"I don't know if that thing is keeping the guard busy or what, but I don't want to push our luck. I've got the hand, and I've already put Dr. Lyle back, so let's get out of here."
I assumed that thing meant the empty wind, but I was pleased to hear him say the good doctor's name in such reverent tones. I was the one who'd done the begging, but it was Dr. Lyle who'd actually saved us. He was the one the empty wind cared about. All of that was too complicated to explain while my throat was killing me, though. So I just let Nick pull me out of the morgue and past the security guard, who didn't even look up from his phone.
"I'm chatting with him on a dating app,"
Sybil explained when I wondered how that was possible. The thank you was on the tip of my tongue when I realized she'd responded to a question I hadn't actually asked.
Stop reading my mind, I hissed.
You can turn it off in my settings,
she informed me helpfully, bringing up her menu to show me where the option was.
But it's not recommended. If I can't access your surface thoughts, how can I get you what you need before you need it? The guard is a perfect example. I felt your brainwaves go crazy, so I decided to run interference while I waited to see if you'd need medical assistance. Fortunately, you did not need assistance. And now, thanks to me, you're not about to be busted by the cops, either. All of this was made possible by my predictive brainwave technology, which, by the way, has been on for the last 3 years. Are you sure you want to turn it off?
I wasn't prepared to make that decision yet, so I let the matter go. As she said, I'd had it on for years without a problem. It was probably only bothering me now because I kept doing things I didn't like, which said more about me than it did about Sybil.
Glad you can see reason,
Sybil said when I closed the options tab.
Just give me a moment to let Mr. Guard down easy and we can get to work on that hand. Speaking of which, I can already tell you the security on most BCI systems is too high for a social AI such as myself to crack. Does Mr. Koss have an expert in mind already? Or should I look one up for us?
Good question.
I've got a place, Nick said when I asked him. It'll be expensive, but it'll be done right.
My stomach sank at the word expensive. But what could I say? I didn't know someone cheap to suggest as an alternative. I just hoped Nick's contract was willing to negotiate a payment plan. I was still wobbly when we reached the car, so Nick got the door for me, which was unexpectedly thoughtful of him. I was still putting my seatbelt on as he dropped into the driver's seat, but he didn't start the car. He just sat there with his hands on the wheel, staring down the orange-lit street with a distant, closed-off look on his face. I was starting to worry he'd gone catatonic again when he said,
"Thank you."
It was nothing, I assured him. I just wish I'd had the idea to appeal to the empty win from Dr. Lyle's side earlier. If I'd been faster on the ball, I wouldn't have had to lie to Peter.
Which I would absolutely have to make amends for later.
I was already planning where I would take the priest for an apology dinner the moment I had money again when Nick shook his head.
Not that, he said. I mean, it was a smart idea. Really smart. But that's not what I...
He trailed off, scrubbing his gloved hands over his face.
What I'm trying to say is thank you,
he finished at last.
You know, for saving my life.
Now I was embarrassed. It wasn't a big deal, I said, brushing my hair awkwardly behind my ears.
It was,
he insisted, his always moving gray eyes perfectly still when he turned to look at me.
I'm no mage, but I still heard the empty wind's voice speaking in my head. He was going to let you go. You could have run away and saved yourself. But you didn't. You stayed.
Of course I stayed, I said with a huff. What was I supposed to do? Let you die? The heavy silence that followed told me that was exactly what Nick had expected. And that made me furious.
Oh, come on, I yelled at him. What kind of monster do you think I am?
Not a monster, he said. Just a person. It's only natural for people to look out for number one.
Awful people, maybe, I huffed. But not everyone. You saved my life earlier.
Only because I wanted a share of your score.
If Nick had jumped in front of a bullet for a share of a wrecked unit before he even knew what was inside, I'd eat my goggles. Yeah, right, I said, giving him a smirk. Just admit it. You're a nice guy. Nick jerked back like I'd stung him.
I am not nice.
Whatever you need to tell yourself.
I'm not,
he insisted.
I just...
He trailed off with a frustrated huff, and I grinned in triumph.
Nice.
Shut up, he growled, starting the car. And for the record, we're even now. Let's just go get that hand cracked so we can get paid.
Sounds good to me, I said, bringing up my map. Where to?
Somewhere not on a map.
I gave him a really look through the glowing interface of my AR, but Nick was already driving down the street, eyes firmly on the road as we left the morgue behind. Remember how I said there were places in the underground where I didn't go? That's where we went. It was out in the boonies by 8 Mile Road, only a few blocks away from the DFC's northern border. Just across the line in Troy, Michigan, apartments were built right up to the border to house the millions of people who wanted to live within the security and laws of the United States while still enjoying the anything-goes freedoms of the DFZ. Naturally, then, the DFZ side of the border had metastasized into a maze of brothels, joy parlors, and drug dens. The whole place was a giant scam designed to separate naive suburbanites from their money. Everything was overpriced, and of vastly lower quality compared to what you could get downtown. But behind the hard, candy-colored shell of cynical opportunism that coated the border was a real underworld that sold to the scammers. And that was where Nick took us.
Are you sure we're in the right place? I asked nervously as Nick turned down an alley behind a VR porn theater. It seems kind of dodgy.
Then we'll fit right in, Nick said. We're hiring someone to hack into a hand. Even for the DFZ. That's not exactly legitimate business.
Couldn't argue with that logic. But knowing I was part of the problem didn't make me any less jumpy as we turned into a gravel lot surrounded by razor wire. Nick passed a 20 to the old man sitting in a folding chair at the gate, which struck me as a lot. I didn't pay that much for parking on the skyways, much less way out here. When I mentioned it to Nick, though, he shook his head.
That's not for parking. It's for protection.
Protection from what? I asked, looking around the lot, which, though surprisingly full, was definitely surrounded by a lot of nothing.
Bad luck, Nick replied, pulling us into a space between two vans. This area is owned by a gang. Which one changes depending on how the turf wars are going. But if you mind your own business and pay your fee, nothing will happen. Most of the time.
I cringed. I'm surprised you're leaving your car here. Isn't it your baby?
It's a tool, he said as he cut the engine. If it's not useful, what's the point? But nothing's going to happen to it. I paid my fee, and everyone here knows my car.
It was on the tip of my tongue to ask why before I came to my senses. Between his strange relationship with Kaufman and how blasé he'd been about getting shot at, it was becoming more and more obvious that cleaning wasn't Nick's only job. Not that I was complaining. Nick's alternate skill set had been very useful so far. But it made me wonder what he's done to make the exurb gangs respect his car. Not that there was anyone around to do so at the moment. Other than the guy who'd taken Nick's money, the lot was empty. Of people, at least. There were plenty of surprisingly nice cars. But then, this was gangland. Gangers were famous for loving their cars. I'd actually been to one of their auto shows my first year in the city, back when I'd been super into all the, oh wow, look at all this stuff that's illegal everywhere else, DFZ tourist crap. But while the cars were quite nice, they were the only show around. I didn't even see so much as a sketchy club in the surrounding buildings. Just cheap warehouse stores, fast food joints, coffin motels, and the back of a tacky vice strip that faced the border. So where are we going? I asked, gripping the bag that held Dr. Lyle's hand with both of mine as Nick and I walked across the gravel lot.
You said you had an expert.
I do, Nick said. And we're here.
Unless Nick's guy was an expert at rigging slot machines,
I didn't see what he'd be doing out here.
I was opening my mouth to say as much when Nick opened a metal door in the back of the warehouse that formed the rear wall of the gravel lot and started to climb the cement stairwell inside. I followed hesitantly, grumbling under my breath. I've been to some pretty sketchy places as a cleaner, but this was pinging my bad idea-o-meter big time. Bad things happened in small, enclosed stairwells at the edge of town. It didn't help that it smelled horrible. A mix of urine, old metal, and dead animal baking in the summer heat. Nick didn't even seem to notice the reek. He just kept going, taking the stairs two at a time, up, 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 until we reached the door to the roof. The moment he opened it, a blast of smoky, hot air and thumping music filled the stairwell. My first thought was a roof party, but I was thinking way too small. Because when I stepped out after him, I found myself standing in the middle of an entire shopping district. High above the cheap vice at the edge of the DFZ was a second suspended world of metal walkways and corrugated steel buildings, clinging like neon-lit wasp nests from the bottom of the giant commuter highway that connected the Michigan suburbs to the DFZ. But these weren't more tourist traps. Everything up here seemed to be targeted at the DFC's working criminal community. I'd never seen so many high-end gun vendors and esoteric magical supply stores in one place. Going by the blinking AR signs, they seemed to be selling real quality products for pretty reasonable prices, which explained the crowd. The rooftop we'd come out on was packed with people carrying guns every bit as nice as Nick's. And it was just one island in a vast suspended network running down the underside of the highway for as far as I could see. "Whoa," I said, stepping away from Nick to peer over the edge of the warehouse at the parking lot we'd just come from. How did I miss this? The music alone was loud enough to hear for blocks, let alone 50 feet down.
"It's warded," Nick said casually,
pointing at the air, which I could now see was indeed shimmering with the biggest look-away ward I'd ever encountered. I whistled in appreciation, glancing up the ramps at the packed nightclubs, bars, and noodle shops that were crammed in between the shops. This place beat the pants off my usual shopping destinations, which only made the fact that someone had spent so much magic and effort to hide it all the more surprising. "I don't get it," I said to Nick as we walked up the nearest ramp. "I could see hiding a place like this somewhere normal, but this is the DFZ. Everything's legal here. Why would you want to keep such an awesome place secret from potential customers?"
"Because not everything is legal," he replied,
pointing at a pawn shop that was pretty obviously a fence for stolen goods.
"But the lookaway isn't for the cops. The people up here run very specialized businesses. The last thing they want is a bunch of suburban tourists taking pictures and driving away real customers."
If that was what they wanted, then it seemed to me they shouldn't have set up shop above a tourist trap. That said, a lot of the suspended businesses had connections down to the roofs of the gaudy love palaces and theme park-style opium dens below, which told me there was a symbiotic relationship going on here. They might not want the tourists, but the shysters who conned them were another breed of client entirely.
"Welcome to the DFZ," I said, shaking my head. "Criminals all the way down."
"It is called the City of Commerce," Sybil whispered in my ear. "The place where anything is possible."
"And everything is sticky," I said with a grimace, pressing myself against the walkway's metal railing to get away from the drunk who was puking over the other side.
"Don't think the ward's going to stop that."
No,
Sybil said, tilting one of my cameras down toward the ramp's floor, which, now that we were off the warehouse roof, was just an iron grid suspended 50 feet above the street.
"Watch your step."
I winced and scooted closer to Nick, following so tightly that it was a challenge not to step on his heels.
"Where are we going again?"
"Not much farther,"
he said, pushing his way through the heavily armed crowd that was waiting to get into a strip club.
"Stay close."
If I stayed any closer, he'd be giving me a piggyback ride. But I didn't argue. Thanks to the narrow walkways, the place was dense. If we got separated, my chances of finding Nick again in the packed crowd were not good, especially since I didn't have his phone number. That was an oversight I'd need to fix pronto. But before I could ask, Nick turned sharply, yanking open the door of a large shop so covered in overlapping advertisements, I couldn't actually read any of them. I scurried after him, eyes wide from my first look at wherever it was we were. After all that build-up, I was hoping for some kind of smoky VR den like you saw in the movies, but the place actually looked more like a tattoo parlor than anything else. There was a waiting area with red velvet couches and an attractive pink-haired receptionist fending off customers who ran the gamut from nervous to bored to high out of their minds. Being a hanging box like everything else up here, the walls were corrugated steel and the roof was the cement bottom of the highway. But you couldn't see any of that through the AR-projected posters of insanely attractive men and women flexing various artificial body parts, which was where I got my first clue as to what this place was. It was a mod parlor, a place that sold and installed cyberware. Ever since the second Mana crash had tripled the relative magic of the world, the enhancements industry had been booming. When 40% of the human population was born magical, the other 60 was under intense pressure to compensate, and most did so in the form of better-than-human augmentations. Cybernetics could make you see better, run faster, jump higher, and punch harder. They could improve your memory, your balance, your reflexes. They could also leave you crippled and brain-dead if done improperly, which was why most countries had laws prohibiting the more dangerous procedures. But this was the DFZ. You could get your phone wired straight into your frontal lobe if you were willing to pay for it. Installers didn't even have to have a medical license. Mod parlors like this were everywhere, offering superhuman improvements at a variety of price points, depending on how picky you were about what went into your body. I wasn't sure how nice this place was. The clientele in the waiting area looked like the usual mix of street thugs and blue-collar workers who liked a little something under the hood. But Nick walked right into the back with nothing more than a wave at the receptionist. So I could only assume they were good enough for what we needed them to do. I just hoped I could afford my half when the bill came. Clutching my bag with the hand inside, I followed Nick inside, scurrying through the projected waterfall curtain that separated the waiting area from the installation rooms, of which there were a surprising number. The few mod parlors I'd seen had had two or three rooms at most, but this place had over a dozen, including what looked like a full-sized hospital-grade operating theater for putting in the really tricky stuff, like artificial spinal columns. Clearly, this place was way more serious than your average strip mall cyberware vendor. I'd never even heard of some of the augments displayed for sale on the walls. I was still gawking like a tourist when Nick suddenly turned a corner and opened a door into one of the private rooms. I followed tight on his heels, braced for some kind of crazy street doc operating chamber. But the room wasn't bloody or scary. It was actually quite nice. A little cubicle the size of a dentist's office, decorated with carpets and velvet-shaded floor lamps. There was an operating table, of course, and thick wall hangings to muffle the sound of drills, but otherwise the place looked more like a new-age massage parlor than an underground cyber clinic. If Nick had told me we were here to get our chakras aligned, I probably would have believed him, if not for the woman organizing gleaming surgical steel tools on a rolling cart in the far corner. While the rest of the room hadn't fit my expectations for this place, she surpassed them. With her white lab coat tossed on over black leather pants and high-heeled boots, the woman looked like she'd been sent over from central casting to play a back-alley doctor in a government film about the dangers of illicit cyberware. Her dark hair was long on one side and shaved close on the other, but aside from the red light gleaming on her ear where an earring would have been, I didn't see any obvious modifications. And then she turned around. I must have jumped a foot. From the back, the woman had looked relatively normal, but her front told an entirely different story.
She wasn't even wearing a shirt under her lab coat. It was all just silver. Beautiful, gleaming silver engraved with leaves and birds. The enhancement ran from the top of her neck into her low-slung pants. Maybe it went back to flesh after that, but for all I knew, she was silver down to her toes. The only part of her that still looked human was her head. But even that was suspect when I looked closer. Her brown skin was too perfect. Her dark eyes too sharp. And there was that red light in her ear, blinking like a warning as she flashed us an absolutely straight, absolutely white grin.
Nicola!
She said in a voice that was as artificially perfect as the rest of her.
What are you doing back so soon? Don't tell me you've already broken the news.
She trailed off when she spotted me, and her eyes lit up with a delight so sharp it was terrifying.
You brought a girl?
She's not a girl, Nick snapped.
I whirled on him. Of course I'm a girl. What did you think I was?
Not like that,
he corrected, his ears turning ever so slightly red.
Not like she means, I meant. That is...
He gave up after that, throwing a hand out toward the machine woman instead.
Opal, this is Rena. Rena, Opal.
So pleased to meet you, Opal,
Rena purred, stalking across the carpet. Are you getting something done today?
No, I said quickly, taking a step back.
That was when I knew that Rena's face was as artificial as the rest of her. Because while her eyes were immediately disappointed, it took the rest of her expression a full second to catch up.
That's too bad, she said, looking at me. It's so rare that I get to work on a virgin canvas.
It had been a long time since I was a virgin anything, but I had the feeling saying as much would make this situation worse, not better. So I kept my mouth shut, digging into my bag instead.
The job's not for me, I said, pulling out Dr. Lyle's hand. We need the information that's locked inside this.
Never taking her eyes off mine, Rena reached out and took the hand. Her silver fingers were the same temperature as the air when they brushed mine, which was a lot creepier than I expected. Usually, cyberware keeps itself at normal body temperature so it won't feel false, but Rena's touch felt like an inanimate object. Like she wasn't there at all.
Do you have the security key?
She asked, petting my fingers one last time with that dead touch before I jerked them away.
No, Nick said. No security question answers either. Just the hand. There's a location hard-coded into its VCI. We need it out.
She wrinkled her nose.
That's a tall order,
she said, turning the hand over to look at the connectors on the wrist. And speaking of orders, the boss wants to see you, Nicky.
Tell him to wait,
Nick said, crossing his arms over his chest.
I'm doing this right now.
Rena snorted.
You can tell him to wait. My head might be replaceable, but that doesn't mean I like having it bitten off.
It'll take me a few minutes to give you an estimate on the hand, anyway. And he's already seen you on the cameras, so you might as well go up.
I'll keep an eye on your little opal.
The way she said that made my skin crawl. But the boss thing must have been legitimate, because Nick sighed.
Fine,
he growled, looking at me.
I'll be right back. Don't leave this room.
He didn't have to tell me that. As creepy as Rena was, I'd watched enough crime dramas to know that anywhere they called their boss the boss was not a place you wanted to go exploring by yourself.
I'd already glued my back to the parlor's padded wall, pulling in just enough magic to activate my wards before pulling my arms inside my poncho to keep as much of my body inside the protective shield as possible. Sybil was on high alert as well, running her full suite of security protocols and keeping my cameras moving so that I had a 360-degree view of the room. Given how much machinery she was packing, I was certain Rena noticed me locking my doors, so to speak,
but she was either too polite to comment or couldn't be bothered to care, because she went on as though nothing had changed. She just gave Nick a wink and turned around, carrying Dr. Lyle's hand to the back of the room, where she pushed the padded curtains aside to reveal a wall of equipment. "So," she said, placing the hand inside a device that looked exactly like, but couldn't possibly be, a microwave. "Where did Nick pick you up?"
"I'm the one who picked him up, actually," I said, ignoring the blatant innuendo in her voice. "He wanted in on my job. I needed someone with a car. So we teamed up."
Rena's head snapped around to gape at me over her shoulder. "Wait, Nick let you ride in his car? For real?" She sounded legitimately shocked, and I shifted uncomfortably.
"It's just for tonight. My tires got slashed, so..."
"There is no just when it comes to Nikola Koss," she said firmly. "He never lets anyone into his stuff. Not unless they're paying enough to buy him an upgrade." She pursed her lips. "So what's he charging you?"
"He's not charging me anything," I said. "As I already said, we're working together on a job."
"Must be some job," she said, turning back to punch a few buttons on the couldn't be a microwave. "So you two aren't..."
"No," I said firmly, angry that my face was heating up.
Rena chuckled. "Pity. And here I thought he'd finally gotten himself a girlfriend." I shook my head so hard it made me dizzy.
"He's all yours."
"Oh, I'm not interested in Nikki," Rena said matter-of-factly. "I don't like men, and I don't take lovers who don't have at least as much cyber as I do." That must have made her choices severely limited. I'd never heard of someone with as much cyberware as Rena who wasn't a military cyborg. "Nick's just a client," she went on. "I do all his cyberware." My head shot up in confusion.
"Nick has cyberware?"
Because I hadn't seen it. I mean, I knew he was fast, but all the cyberware I'd encountered had been obvious. Huge muscles, leg extenders, metal skin like Rena's. Stuff you couldn't hide. But I'd been sitting next to Nick all night, and other than his quickness, which could have just been a combination of training and paranoia, I hadn't noticed a thing.
"Oh, honey,"
Rena said, giving me a wink. "He's got features. Not surprised you haven't seen them, though. Nicky likes to keep his cards hidden. But I bet he'd show you if you asked nicely."
"It's not like that."
"It could be if you want it," she said with a smile. "He's already let you into his car, so he must like you. You should give it a try." Her eyes flicked pointedly to my warded poncho. "Aren't slumming rich girls like you always looking for the bad boy experience?" I didn't know which part of that statement to be more insulted by. The implication that the life I'd killed myself to build in this city was slumming, or that I was only using Nick as a tourist attraction. Not that she could have known any of that, of course. I was just someone Nick had brought in. And I was wearing a magical security garment normally reserved for diplomats and the children of politicians. I should have given her the benefit of the doubt. But it had been a very long, very stressful day. And I wasn't in the mood to be charitable to someone who felt comfortable insulting me to my face.
"I don't know why you think I care," I said in a voice that was a perfect mimicry of my father's. "If you want to antagonize Nick, do it on your own time. But I'm on a deadline. Now how long will it take me to get the information out of that hand?"
I braced for Rena to explode after I finished. Most people did when you talked to them as if they were beneath you, which was one of the reasons my father and I didn't get along. But while I would have, and had, blown up over being dressed down like that, Rena started to giggle.
"Oh, you are too precious," she cried. "Look at you, trying to be scary. like a hissing kitten.
I rolled my eyes as she dissolved into laughter. Honestly, though, I wasn't pissed it hadn't worked. Even when I did manage it, I'd never liked being scary. I was getting really annoyed, though. So much so that I was considering just walking out when Rena finally got herself together.
Sorry. Sorry, she said, wiping her eyes, which were completely dry. I'll stop teasing you, and the hand will take at least 8 hours.
I blinked. Seriously?
It takes time to crack a safe, she said, tapping on the door of the device where the hand was being scanned. Cyberware is made to be secure. Even the cheap stuff is nearly impossible to crack. If it wasn't, no one would use it. And before you ask, no, I can't do it faster. I have to fake a DNA sequence just to get the thing to turn on, and that's not counting dealing with whatever additional security might be inside. If you want your information, you'll just have to be patient.
I cursed under my breath. I didn't know enough about decrypting cyberware to say if 8 hours was reasonable or not, but it was longer than I'd expected. If things had been normal, I would have welcomed the chance to go back to my apartment and crash. But if Kaufman had paid thugs to watch Dr. Lyle's empty house for a month, he'd definitely have someone camping my door. That meant home was out. But I didn't have the money to go anywhere else.
Oh, you look so sad, Rena said, reaching out to snag a lock of my hair before I could jerk away. Don't worry, kitten. If Nikki isn't taking care of you, you can always stay with me. I don't have any more appointments tonight. And there's nothing I love better than easing newcomers into the joys of cyberware.
She tilted her head, looking my body over like an interior decorator deciding which pieces of furniture had to go first.
We could start with your eyes. I just got a pair in that would look gorgeous on you, and you could get rid of those bulky goggles.
No, thank you. I like my eyes the way they are.
Are you sure?
She purred, reaching out to stroke the skin at the top of my cheekbone.
I can give you a fantastic deal.
Very sure, I said, backing over to the door. I'm just gonna wait outside for Nick.
She looked supremely disappointed, but she didn't try to stop me.
I almost wished she had. 8 hour wait notwithstanding, I really didn't want to abandon Dr. Lyle's hand in a strange place, and Nick had told me specifically not to leave the room. But I didn't like the vibe I was getting one bit. And while I was confident in my ability to defend myself with magic if it came to that, frying the person who was getting us our information was not how I wanted this job to end. So instead, I removed myself from the situation, slipping into the dark hallway to wait for Nick. I didn't have to wait long. I'd only played 2 rounds of Monster Poker on my phone before I heard Nick coming down the hall. I hadn't even realized I could recognize his footsteps until that moment, but Nick had a very specific way of walking, full speed and straight ahead, that made him easy to pick out. I already had my game shut down and my phone back in my pocket when he came around the corner and froze.
What are you doing?
He hissed frantically.
I told you to stay in the room.
You left me with a creepy lady,
I hissed back. My choices were magic or hallway.
Since she's the one decoding our hand, I chose hallway. You can thank me later.
Nick didn't look surprised.
Sorry about her, he said. As you can tell from her body, Rena doesn't know when to stop. But she's reliable when it comes to work. Is she decoding the hand?
That or microwaving it, I said. She said it'd take 8 hours.
I expected him to balk at that, but Nick actually looked relieved.
It'll be safe with her for a while, then. We've got bigger problems.
I cringed. Something happened with the boss, didn't it?
What?
Nick said, surprised.
No, Jauncey's solid. He'd never sell out a client. Bad for business.
He just called me back to warn me that Kaufman's put a bounty on our heads.
Wait, really? He nodded, and my eyes went wide. For how much?
Nick cocked an eyebrow at me.
Does it matter?
Not particularly, but I'd never had a bounty on my head.
I just want to know how much we're worth to him.
25 grand each.
Is that a lot? Because it sounded like a lot.
Enough to draw a crowd from the people who saw us come in,
Nick said, pulling his gun.
Which is why we're going out the back.
He pushed past me down the hall, which I thought was a dead end. But when Nick reached out to touch the black painted wall, it turned out to actually be a black painted door leading out onto another suspended walkway. A much, much narrower one than the route we'd taken to get here.
Stay close and keep your head down,
Nick whispered, keeping his gun ready as he crept outside.
We follow this until it dead ends. There's another stair we can use in a...
He never got to finish. At that moment, the door he'd been easing open was ripped out of his hands. Standing behind Nick, I couldn't see our attacker's face, but I could see the machete in his hand, its gleaming blade already flying low toward Nick's stomach.